Bonsoir, mesdames, messieurs, professeurs, chers collègues, mesdames, messieurs, chers amis. Je suis très heureux de vous accueillir ce soir pour la deuxième série de conférences dans le cadre du cycle Europe du Collège de France, cycle qui s'inscrit dans une longue tradition de réflexion du Collège de France et l'Europe. Vous le savez, le Collège de France, depuis sa création en 1530, dans le contexte de l'humanisme, s'est dès le début ouvert sur l'Europe, convaincu que la science, la recherche, la diffusion de la recherche ne connaissent pas de frontières. D'ailleurs, de nombreux professeurs et professeurs originaires des pays européens ont enseigné et enseignent aujourd'hui au Collège de France. Ainsi, notre institution bénéficie d'une longue tradition de réflexion et de débat sur l'Europe qui n'a eu de cesse d'occuper les professeurs et chercheurs du Collège de France. Une des dernières manifestations de cet intérêt aura été la chaire « L'invention de l'Europe par les langues et les cultures », chaire créée en partenariat avec le ministère de la Culture que nous avons pu inaugurer jeudi dernier. Et le colloque de rentrée, qui aura lieu le 21-22 octobre, auquel vous êtes évidemment aussi cordialement invités, sera également consacré à l'Europe et à ses nombreux défis. Ce cycle Europe a pour but d'accompagner cette réflexion en faisant appel à des acteurs et observateurs de la construction européenne qui traiteront des différents aspects de cette question. Je voudrais remercier chaleureusement mes collègues Samantha Besson, Edith Hurt et Vinciane Pierenne qui se sont engagés dans ce projet. Un grand merci aussi à la Fondation Hugo du Collège de France qui a largement contribué à sa réalisation. Après Luc Van Middelaar, qui a ouvert ce cycle avec une série de quatre conférences autour du thème « L'Europe géopolitique, actes et paroles », nous avons ce mois le privilège d'accueillir le célèbre politologue Ivan Krastev, président du Centre for Liberal Strategies de Sofia, en Bulgarie, et membre permanent de l'Institute for Human Science, j'aurais dû le dire en allemand, mais je sais que la version anglaise, de Vienne, en Autriche. Il est également membre fondateur du Conseil européen des relations étrangères. Il écrit régulièrement des articles pour le New York Times et d'autres journaux. Il est l'auteur de nombreux essais, dont certains ont été traduits en français. « Est-ce déjà demain, le monde paradoxal de l'après-Covid-19 en 2020 ?»« Le moment illibéral », coécrit avec Stephen Holmes, lauréat de la troisième édition du prix annuel Lionel Gelbert, « Le destin de l'Europe » et d'autres titres en anglais. En 2020, Ivan Krastev a reçu le prix Jean Amery de l'essai européen. Les quatre conférences qu'il prononcera au Collège de France, en anglais, comme ça a été annoncé, ont comme titre général « L'angoisse du déclin ». Démocratie, démographie et le clivage entre l'Est et l'Ouest en Europe. Cette série se propose d'analyser la façon dont les majorités ethnoculturelles en diminution dans les États membres de l'Union européenne tentent de préserver leur pouvoir et leur identité face à leur propre déclin démographique et à l'arrivée des migrants. La thèse défendue par Ivan Krastev est que le conflit actuel entre libéralisme et illibéralisme en Europe n'est autre que l'expression de la rivalité entre deux images opposées du peuple que se choisissent différents gouvernements. Si Ivan Krastev semble donner un conseil, on va le voir, à ceux qui chaque jour font l'Europe, c'est bien de faire preuve de souplesse et de conciliation. En effet, l'Union européenne ne pourra survivre et se développer qu'en prenant en considération les opinions de toutes et de tous, en créant le compromis entre eux et elle, et tout particulièrement entre Européens de l'Est et de l'Ouest. Dear Ivan Krastev, we are very happy to have you here. Before you start, there is a little ritual in the Collège de France. You will receive a medal with Guillaume Budet and with your name, so you can remember your stay here. And we are very happy to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and it is great that you're giving the medal before I have spoken. So even if I'm going to disappoint you, you cannot take it back. Thank you very much. It's a real privilege, and you know that I mean it to be here and to have the opportunity. So when Professor Besson invited me to give these lectures, to be honest, I was surprised. This is one of the institutions in which I never expected to be invited to give a lecture. Even I was reminded for interesting art installation that I saw some years ago in Sofia. And the installation was the following. The artists have been visiting different famous art museums in the world. And he was recording the audio guide, which explains what you're seeing and the history of the paintings that you're looking at. And then he organized the exhibition in Sofia, in which you enter into the room. In the exhibition, all walls are empty. It's only the names of the paintings, and then you can listen to the audio recording. So from this point of view, for me, Collège de France was slightly like this. I have known a lot about it, but I have never seen it. So now, for the first time, kind of visited personally. Before coming here, I also was talking to Luc van Middelrooy and said, basically, give me an advice what I should do with this lecture series. And he said, first, it is best to speak in French. Unfortunately, on this, I cannot deliver. My only excuse is that my kids speak French, so probably this is for the course. Secondly, he said, read better your lecture. Have a written lecture and read it. But on this, I also cannot deliver, because 20 years ago, I tried to do it. At some point, even I was not understanding what I was doing. And the third was, be interesting. And with this one, I don't know exactly what you're doing. So his advices were great, but I don't believe that they were very useful. But I tried, and I'll start to introduce my topic. And my topic, in fact, is on the politics of the demographic imagination in Europe. And I'll start basically introducing it through a novel of a Bulgarian author, which was just published very recently. And the plot of the story is the following. An old man dies somewhere in a remote village in Bulgaria. He was 92 years old. He was the last person living in the village. So even it took some time for the people to discover that he has died. And of course, nobody was going to notice his death if it was not for the fact that because of his death, the population of the country dropped under 7 million people. And this created a moral panic in the country, because in 1989, the population of Bulgaria was 9 million. By the way, Bulgaria is the fastest shrinking demographically country in the world in the absence of war or natural disasters. So suddenly, the death of the person and the moral panic that he triggered become a political issue. People start asking ourselves, we are going to vanish. Are there going to be Bulgarians around in the next 100 years? Why this is happening? Is it democracy to blame? Is the European Union that is emptying us? And the president of the country, kind of a typical profile that you have for our country, is kind of combination between certain level of mediocrity and pedestrian type of nationalism, decided that something should be done. The thing that he cannot do is to open the country for migration, because the reason he was elected back in 2015 was that he promised that not a single migrant is going to enter the country. So in the way Columbus started to go and to look for land, a new land for the Spanish crown, the president sent an anthropological expedition in order to try to find some left out Bulgarians somewhere. And as you can imagine, it's a satirical novel, by the way, nicely written. So they found somewhere in Central Asia, I know that there is a special in Central Asia, in one of the regions in which 70 generations ago, proto-Bulgarians came from, they found a community of around 500,000 people who anthropologists said, listen, they should be our cousins. So the president gets very excited. First, if these people are going to get Bulgarian passports, it means that we're going to be back to 7.5, and all people are going to be Bulgarians. But secondly, because he made a deal with the authoritarian leader of this country, that all of them are going to vote for him on the presidential elections. At the end of the book, it didn't turn out in the way people expected. People took their Bulgarian passports, and because they were EU passports, they left the country. All they came to France and Germany, and there was nobody to vote for the president. But I'm telling this story because in a certain way it captures several things that are very important for me in trying to discuss the relations between democracy, demography, and basically what we are seeing in Europe. The first is the importance of the demographic anxiety, particularly when it comes to the small ethnic nations which you see in Central and Eastern Europe. This idea of fear of ethnic disappearance, extremely strong, because if you're going to compare Central and Eastern Europe to Western Europe, you're going to see that basically the fertility rates are the same. What is different is the very high level of out-migration. A lot of people has left the country for the last 30 years. You're going to see many of them here in Paris. So as a result of it, for the last 30 years, Central and East European countries as a whole lost a population which is equal to the population of the Hungary and the Czech Republic if they're put together. This is a big change. And this demographic decline created a lot of anxieties and basically, in my view, started to create a lot of problems. But it's not only this. The idea that people in democracy, government change because people change their mind is one of the versions of how basically power is changing in a democratic societies. But also power can change if the population changes. And we know from history, this happens when, for example, you have something like the unification of Germany and you have a kind of a new big pool of voters which are entering the body politics. You can see it in the way, for example, it happened in Israel when after the end of the Soviet Union, you have a major kind of a pool of Soviet Jews that went there. And by the way, this also happened in Eastern Europe where after the opening of the borders, you have a lot of young people who left the countries. So the body politics is changing dramatically. And what is interesting, in my view, in the intuition of the author, Oleg Popov is his name of this book, is that suddenly the combination between the demographic decline, the demographic anxiety, the mobility of the people, and the need for a new people create a situation which very much reminded us of a story that Brecht told in 1953 when he said, if the government does not like the people, why they are not going to elect a new people? Listen, in a democracy, governments always try to elect the people. They are doing this by shaping the citizenship laws, by shaping the electoral laws. And the question, could it be that people are going to be selected on the basis of how they're going to vote on the next elections, is something of the problematics coming very much as a result of this satirical story. I'm saying all this because, in my view, demography is one of the things that is extremely important for the way our democracies are going to change in the coming decades. But it is also very difficult to talk about for several reasons. One is because the talk about demography these days is not talk about the real situation of what is happening demographically. It is much more about what I'll try to define as the demographic imagination. And this is a strange combination between the real shift of populations, the new mobility, but also these projections with which people are living. All these projections, how our societies are going to look in 20 years and 30 years. God knows is these projections going to be true, because we know with the demographic projections, it does not always work in the way they have been planned. But now they have become a part of this political reality, which is mobilizing voters. And it's not by accident that demography and the demographic discourse became one of the major discourse of the far right all over Europe, and particularly strong in Central and Eastern Europe. Just in a preparation for my lecture series, just 10 days ago in Budapest, there was a big conference on demography attended by the Hungarian Prime Minister, by the Czech Prime Minister, by Mike Pence, the former Vice President of the United States. So the idea of a demography is becoming critically important, and it is critically important also for the fact that COVID-19 strengthened additionally this type of a demographic anxiety. Because if you look around, strangely enough, COVID, long COVID years through which we are going, was a kind of a particularly demographic moment. The moment when the virus arrived, all of us knew exactly how old we are. Because the risk of dying has been doubling with every 8 years. Secondly, because when we are going to be vaccinated depends on how old you are. Secondly, it's not simply that you learn about your own age, and the famous formulas that the 60 is the new 40 were not as powerful as they used the day before. But suddenly we also learn how many people older than 80 are living in our societies. Because most of these people were very invisible before. Some of them staying in the old nursing houses. And then suddenly we learn how young people are learning in our countries, and there were not many of them. I'm saying all this because it's not simply that demography became visible, but secondly also because of COVID, more than ever before, the ordinary citizen starts to think about in terms of exponential growth and projections. Psychologists have been arguing that for the ordinary person, it's very difficult to think in terms of exponential growth. It's very difficult to understand why if today we have 10 people infected, tomorrow we're going to have 100, and the day after tomorrow we're going to have 1,000. But because of all this social experience that we get, thinking in terms of exponential growth became much more closer to the people, and then these demographic projections started to look totally differently. Plus, during the COVID, we start very much to have a better understanding of how populated the country is and where it is populated. Suddenly, people started to be interested to go to places which are less crowded. Suddenly, we see the demography of all this. And this is quite interesting because when we're talking about a country like Bulgaria, I told you that we have this absolutely incredible demographic shrinking, and the projection is that around 2040, the country is going to be inhabited by 5.5 million people. But what is even more interesting, 68% of the country is going to be what is called demographic desert, which means less than 10 persons per square kilometer. So I'm saying all this because I do believe COVID basically strengthened two types of an imagination, which I found particularly important, and this is my starting point to try to analyze the situation in Europe. I'm going to argue that instead of thinking in terms of traditional opposition between left and right that have been structuring European politics for a long time, we saw the rise of two very powerful political imaginations, both of them, to be honest, quite apocalyptical. One is the ecological one. It comes very much from the climate activists. This is basically Extinction Rebellion. This is the feeling that if we're going to do nothing to change the way we're living and the way we're producing, probably in not so distant future, there's not going to be life on Earth. And on the other is demographic. This is not about basically that the life is going to die. The problem is that our way of life is going to die. And this is very much this demographic imagination, which I'm using demographic imagination very much following the famous book in 1959, Wright Mills wrote the book Sociological Imagination, which was quite important for sociology in the 60s and 70s. And his major story was, for him, sociological imaginations was trying to reconcile the way people are making sense of their personal biography and the biggest structural trends in the world. I do believe the demographic imagination basically is trying to reconcile the imagination of the people to the groups to which they belong, to the global situation and the global trends. And here we are entering, when we talk about the demographic imagination in Europe, a paradox that had been captured very early on in 1992 by the German writer Hans Magnus Enzensberger, who basically defined the term demographic bulimia. And demographic bulimia, according to him, is this double fear that on one level there are too many people in the world, and on the other there are too few. Too many of them and too few of us. And this strange type of a structure in which the population of the world is increasing all the time and probably is going to increase till 2050, but at the same time you have the feeling that your own communities are shrinking, created this particular powerful demographic imagination that I do believe is critically important to understanding basically what is happening in the politics in Europe in general, but I'm going to argue that it is particularly important to try to to see what is happening in Central and Eastern Europe and how the Central and East European regimes basically have been legitimized. And listen, this is really important, and as I said it, COVID-19 very much contributed to two things. First, make all these kind of fears much more urgent. Italian Prime Minister Draghi was speaking some months ago on a conference very much devoted to the issue, and he said that in Italy has just 404,000 births last year, which is the lowest since records began, and down 30% than 12 years ago. And in the case of Bulgaria, during the COVID-19, Bulgaria lost more people than during the World War II. So this kind of a strange combination in which you're becoming much more aware of death, but also much more aware of basically how you are using this, in my view, is particularly important. Because if you go to literature, and from this point of view, mass culture is quite important, you're going to see that there was a very strong connection between all dystopias devoted to the problem of sterility and the loss of democracy. Strangely enough, if 30 years ago, all the demographic nightmares and all the demographic dystopias were based on the Malthusian fears of too many people and not enough food, it's not by accident that in the same year in which basically Fukuyama published his book, The End of History and the Last Man, a novel had been published called The Children of Men. And this was the story of how in 1995, suddenly England became totally sterile and not a single new baby had been born, and how it led to the dictatorship. I'm putting all these questions because now when we're talking about the demography as the way we're seeing the changes of European politics, and I'm going to argue that we're going to see a lot of changes and that some of these changes are going to be very much related to some of the issues that we're talking about, comes the story. Let's try to imagine European politics very much structured by these two imaginations. On one's the ecological imagination and on the other the demographic imaginations. And honestly speaking, they come with a totally different normative claims towards the people living on Earth. In its radical version, the claim coming from ecological imagination is how moral is to give a birth in a world which is totally overpopulated and which basically we're increasing and increasing even more the risk of the Earth dying. And on the other side is the demographic imperative, which comes from East European governments who said, everybody who is not going to have at least three children is basically committing a crime. Every woman is creating a crime against the nation. They go strongly against each other. And my first argument is going to be that in the West and in the East, these two imaginations, kind of one of them predominates. If you're going even to compare the popularity for the Green parties and so on, you're going to see with small exceptions that they're not particularly strong in Central and Eastern Europe. But now when I'll try to use this argument about these two imaginations that manage to basically mobilize people, get people on the street, the normally people who are going to the street is either going to be the young people, Friday for Future, which is very much trying to speak also on behalf of those who are not born yet and probably are not going to be born if we're not going to change our way of lives, or you're going to see a very strong nationalist populist rallies who are speaking on behalf of that and trying to get them represented in the debate as somebody who also have the right of representation. I'm saying this because this is going to allow me to come and try from this to answer the question, how important is East-West divide in Europe and how to think about it. I'll start with this because in political terms, the East-West divide is not the most important in Europe. If you are just going to the level of political attitudes, you're going immediately to see that the most important divide in Europe is between the big urban centers and the rural areas, and this is true everywhere. There is a lot of talk about illiberalism and populism in Central and Eastern Europe, but all major Central and East European capitals are governed by liberal parties or liberal mayors, to the extent of some of them much more progressive than the national body politics as a whole. Croatia and the new mayor of Zagreb being the latest example of this. And secondly, if you see also on the voting patterns, you're going to see that particularly in the last years, the generational divide is becoming more and more important. It's enough to look at the last German elections in order to see that basically the vote of the people younger than 30 in a very high percentage went to the two smaller parties that are going to be part of the coalitions, to the Greens and to the Liberals. And the CDU, for example, get 11% of the vote of the people who are younger than 30. So you have this generational divide and you have the rural urban divide, and they're very important if you're trying to answer the questions how people are divided. But when it comes to the future of the European Union, the East-West divide can turn to be much more important for the future of the Union for several reasons, and I'll start basically presenting them. The first is that normally when we talk about divisions of Europe, we know very well that Europe is divided in a different way. It's divided all the time, and this is normal. In a certain way, the idea of diversity is a structural idea about Europe. Even more, if you go about the three or four major crises that we had in Europe for the last 20 years, you're going to see that Europe has been divided in a different ways. For example, first was 2003, the Iraqi war, the famous New Europe, Old Europe. But New Europe was not only Eastern Europe. It was United Kingdom, it was Denmark, it was Italy. So when it comes to the United States divide, basically the pro-Atlantic and the French-German camp were different. So it was not just classical East-West divide. When you go to the financial crisis of 2009, 2010, it was the North-South divide. And it was quite important because it was very much also the divide that redefined Europe as a Europe divided between creditors and debtors. And many, particularly economists, were very much afraid that this division can be really critical for the very survival of the European Union, because this is not a division between equals. Creditors and debtors, they are not equals. One basically owns to the other. This is a power relationship. It's asymmetrical relationship. And while it's one thing to have the relations between poor and rich countries, but between creditors and debtors, this is a different relationship. And then it came the migration crisis, and this was when the East-West divide basically emerged. And it emerged, particularly for many people in Western Europe, in a striking way, for four different reasons. The first is suddenly Central and Eastern Europe come totally united, not only on the level of governments, even on the level of governments there was a nuances, but on the level of public opinions. If you try to see anti-migration sentiment, it was paradoxically to see that countries which are very different in many aspects, because Jack Rupnik is here and he knows the Czech Republic much better than me, but Czech Republic and Poland are very different countries. Czech Republic is the most secular place in Europe. 70% of the Czechs declare themselves as agnostics. Poland is still one of the most religious places in Europe. But when you look at the anti-migrant sentiment, paradoxically, Czech Republic was even more anti-migrant than Poland. And the same was in Hungary, the same was in Bulgaria, the same was in Romania. Even when the governments were trying to get a much more nuanced position, the public opinions were extremely hostile. This shocked many people also because you have a very strong migration sentiment, but they were not migrants. There were migrants going through some of the countries, but there was not many people that wanted to stay in Bulgaria, Romania, or even Hungary. I didn't see many Syrians which basically start learning Hungarian. So as a result of it, you cannot understand how it is possible to have such a strong political mobilization in a moment in which basically the migrants were not there. And thirdly, which in my view also basically came strange, was the question, but how it happened that East Europeans that have been migrating so much themselves, that basically should have been identifying with the migrants because so many people have been living, also some of them Hungarians in 1956, Czechs in 1968, was so kind of insensitive to what is happening. And this created a very important moral divide, particularly countries like Germany and public intellectuals who are very much trying to understand where these divides come from. And here is my argument based very much also on the some work on the opinion polls that I have been doing and the special survey that the European Council on Foreign Relations did. What people do not realize is that part of the hostility comes not simply because of the hostility to migrants. This was the trauma of the people that have already left. It was not only about migration, this was about an out-migration. Suddenly, when we checked, it appeared that East Europeans, we don't know how to talk about open borders within the European Union because they're the best and the worst that has happened to us at the same time. This is the best because I can travel personally, I can study, my kids can be here, and I can work here. This is also the worst because my neighbors are living. And suddenly this story that basically you cannot criticize the open borders in the EU because this is what gives you so much opportunities, but on the other side, this is something that you really fear, was the moment in which all this exploded in during the migration crisis. Suddenly, it was the impossibility for East Europeans to talk about these issues. And then the moment when you basically look and understand that out-migration is becoming a big problem, and in this survey, 51% of the Poles declared that they would be supportive if their government decided to put a border control for their own citizens to leave the country because they're afraid that country to be depopulated. I'm saying this because during the European elections, the last European elections, the strongest predictor which regions in Europe are going to vote for the far right are the regions which have lost the highest percent of the population in the last 10 years. It was not economy. It was not other kind of important type of factors that we are normally looking for. Depopulation turned to be extremely important. And this is when basically this happens, you have a whole kind of a movement in some of the Central and East European governments, very much performed by the populist leaders, who try to basically revisit the very period of enlargement, saying, listen, the story was all the time about the money that are flowing from Brussels and from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, but let's open our eyes. All the money invested in our young people, in their education and so on, they live with them. And basically, we also have a huge transfer of money from East to the West. And in countries like Romania, where for the period between 2007 and 2017, 3.4 million people left the country, 70% of them younger than 40. So this kind of a major depopulation story was very much what came as a result of, if you go behind this total overreaction, otherwise unexplainable. Of course, it has other explanations too during the migration crisis. And then it was when we basically start to understand that kind of an East-West divide can have a much more importance to the future of the European Union than some of the other divisions that we have been seeing. The second reason why this divide is going to be critically important is because, unfortunately, it fits the stereotypes that have been created long ago. Larry Wolf, in his classical study, The Inventing Eastern Europe, basically claims that while during the Renaissance, the major divide in Europe was between the civilized South, the small Italian republics, and the barbarian North, with the Enlightenment, basically it was the East-West divide. It was Eastern Europe that became kind of the constitutive for the civilized Western Europe. In a certain way, Eastern Europe was within Europe, but outside of Europe. It was geographically within Europe, but not on the philosophical geography. It was beyond the civilizational border that Europeans were saying this. And from this point of view, all this attempt, very strong, during the 1970s and 80s by the dissidents in Central and Eastern Europe to replace East with Central Europe was critically important because they were fighting exactly this divide. The famous joke in Poland goes that there was two trains going, one from Moscow to Paris, full of Russians, and the other from Paris to Moscow, full of French people. And basically, at the same time, they arrived on a Warsaw railway station. And both of them has the feeling that they have arrived to their final destination. So this story of the Central Europe as the replacement was critically important. And during the Cold War, it was very much East Europeans trying to fight against essentializing and cultural differences that they said that many people use to justify the Iron Curtain. The paradox is that now some of the political leaders in Central and Eastern Europe are fighting for what they have been fighting against. The idea that Eastern Europe is very different, it's very special, it is culturally totally different, is very important if you're going to listen to Mr. Kaczynski or if you're going to listen to Mr. Orban. This is a different kind of an Europe. And I do believe that this kind of a stereotyping, it also makes much easier for the population to try to imagine the East being very different than the West. For example, if a populist party is winning in Bulgaria, this is what Bulgarians are. If the same party is going to win in Austria, this is an accident. The perception is totally different because these cultural borders are very much strongly existing in the imagination of the people. But there is two other important reasons which makes this divide critically important for the future of Europe. And the first is, and we have been writing a lot about this with Stephen Holmes in our book, The Light That Failed, is that there is a level of resentment outside of just populist leaders that mobilize it when it comes to East Europeans and the period of basically integration to European Union. And this is very much due to the fact that period of the process of European integration was perceived as a period of a kind of imitation. It was our decision to join the Eastern Europe, so this is not about colonizing certain things that are very kind of popular on the far right, but the fact that you want something and that you want to be like somebody else does not make it easier to live with the fact of imitation, particularly in a cultural environment that is all the time insisting that you should be original, that you should be different, that you should be unique. So the story of how it happened that we are all born unique, but we all end up as a copies, is something that was really troubling many East Europeans. And this became particularly strong because it was René Girard who made a very important observation. As you know, he has the obsession with imitation. He believes that imitation explains everything. But on this, I do believe he was extremely insightful, saying that the moment I want to be like somebody else, it means that I'm basically recognizing his or her superiority. If I want to be somebody else, there is something wrong with me. And this moment is becoming critically important because this other person is not God that you want to imitate. This is your neighbor. It exists. It is there. And all the time, this other person or this other institution is very much also judging how well you're imitating. You have all these reports of European Commission saying how much you are like us. And this was very, in my view, skillfully used by politicians in Central and Eastern Europe, trying to mobilize this imitation, and the story was, we do not want to imitate you anymore. We want to be ourselves. The interesting story is that we don't know what it's to be ourselves, because in a certain way, just 30 years ago, ourselves was that we are like you. And I do believe that in a certain way, Eastern Europe is very much caught in this, and there was a great film, by the way, done already in the late 1990s by Krzysztof Kieślowski, a famous Polish movie director. This is a famous trilogy. And the second film is called White, by the way, the three colors are the colors of the French flag. And this is the story of the Polish hairdresser who get married for a French wife, Dominique. But the moment he moved to Paris, he didn't find the work, he gets slightly frustrated, he does not speak the language, so he stopped to perform sexually. And she basically decided to divorce him, and she went on court and basically saying, he's not performing, and he even in the court cannot explain himself. So he went back to Poland, and he was living with the idea of revenge. So he created a very kind of a sophisticated scheme. So his former wife came to Poland and gets arrested there. because paradoxically you wanted to revenge her, but you were in love with her. And I do believe these relations to the European Union, on one level, you believe that you are mistreated, but on the other, this is your only reference point. And this is part of the story of Euroscepticism that you're going to find in Central and Eastern Europe, very different than what, for example, you saw in Brexit or even in places like France. In Eastern Europe, nobody wants to exit the European Union. In a certain way, support for the EU is highest in places like Hungary and Poland. But you want to be different. You want to be treated differently. You cannot be explicit what you want, but you want a different place for you, but you want to stay in the Union. And I'm saying this because I go for the fourth, and in my view also quite important element that makes East-West divide probably more important than we're realizing. We see now, in the last years particularly, that the Cold War narrative is fading away, and basically decolonization narrative is coming much stronger, and basically probably the 20th century now, we realize that the processes of decolonization could have been historically more important than the Cold War. But then if this is the case, then Europe is divided between Western Europe, which was mainly former empires, and Eastern Europe, which was basically former state that have been formed as a disintegration of the continental empires. My colleague from Vienna, the Yale historian Timothy Snyder, had this point very strongly when he said the biggest and most important myth about the European Union is that it was created by the nation states. In the moment when the European Union was created, neither of the founding members was a real nation state. France was still an empire, basically, with everything to follow. Germany tried to be a big empire and basically failed to do it. Italy, their imperial project also basically failing in Africa and other places. Belgium with Congo still being part of it. So suddenly you have this totally different view about diversity, sovereignty. Strangely enough, all of these big West European states have been empires most of their history. And then you have the East Europeans that came as a result of the disintegration of the empires. And for them, basically, they're sharing totally some of the sentiments of the anti-colonial states and anti-colonial movements that come in 1960s outside of Europe. And it means, particularly in our case, two things: total obsession with sovereignty, understand as an absolute sovereignty, and very much concentrated in the executive political power. Sovereignty is the leader, sovereignty is the government, sovereignty is difficult to be shared. And secondly, and I'm going to talk much more about this on my second lecture, total obsession with the idea of the ethnic homogeneity as a precondition for the existence of the state. The very idea of minority, and here there are lawyers knowing it better than me, but basically minorities entered the international law because of the emergence of these post-colonial states in Central and Eastern Europe. There was no particularly kind of a minority treaties concerning minorities in places like France or Germany. It was very much created after the World War II, basically focusing on these new states that have been emerging. And without going much more in this, I just want you to imagine for a while the ethnic map of Europe in 1900 and then the same in 2000. In 1900, you're going to see two Europes. One was ethnically much more homogeneous, and this was Western Europe. It was Germany, it was France, it was the Nordic states. The other, which was extremely ethnically diverse, and this was the former Habsburg lands, the former Ottoman lands. In 1939, almost a third of the population of Poland have been not ethnic Poles. There were Germans, there were Jews, there were Ukrainians. And then you go 100 years, and in these 100 years, several things happened. First, states start traveling. Then basically people have been expelled and you have expulsion and exchange of population. But if you see the ethnic map of Europe in 2000, you're going to see totally symmetrical picture. You have Western Europe, which is much more culturally and ethnically and racially diverse. And you have Central and East European countries that are incredibly homogeneous in the ethnic composition. In 1989, 96% of Poland were ethnic Poles. And I do believe this kind of a totally different understanding between ethnicity and state formation, the idea of ethnicity and sovereignty, is something that I'm going very much to discuss in the next lectures of mine. Because for me, this is interesting, and I'll go basically to the last point of my presentation to make the following story: what is changing with the demographic imagination is that it is totally shattering exactly this type of historically formed views of what is a state, what is basically a nation. Famous anthropologist Clifford Geertz, in 1995, he was giving this lecture in the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, in which I'm permanently fellow. And he, in my view, made one of the most important and insightful observations when it comes to the post-Cold War period. He said, listen, now we all think in terms of unification, convergence. But what happened with the end of the Cold War is that many of the differences that have been not visible before start to be visible again. And secondly, what he said, we are facing two new big questions. What is a state if it is not a nation? And what is a culture if it is not a consensus and a shared way of life? And I do believe some of these very important questions are coming to Europe, and they're going to be articulated very much in this conflict between Eastern Europe, which is now very much dominated by this demographic imagination, and on the other, Western Europe, which is, in my view, much more dominated by this ecological imagination. And while ecological imagination in the normative terms is a much more cosmopolitan, the major story about climate change is that you can save the Earth only if we all do our part. It's not enough for the Europeans or for Bulgarians. You need everybody. You need to be cosmopolitan in order to respond to this. And on the other side, basically, you have a totally different version of demographic imagination, is that the only thing that really matters is to try to save your way of life, and this is very much threatened by these demographic shifts, by demographic decline, by bigger migration, and that the way and the world as we know it is not going to be there anymore. So this is kind of the introduction to my four lecture course that you have been so generous to offer me to deliver. I don't know how well I'm doing with time, but there was something about Collège de France that I liked very much when I was reading what all this is about some many years ago. And what I learned, probably wrongly, that this is a place which always has been very much encouraging research in progress. And basically, people believed that coming with the right questions from time to time is as valuable to have the right answers. Because I don't have the feeling that I have not only the right answers, but answers at all. At least my ambition is to come with the right questions. So thank you very much.